Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Hi, this is Brad. My guest today is Bill Prystok, but the opening segment's going to be a little different. Justine has this week off. I had a conversation with Vance and Baz over at Rope Podcast, where we discuss each other's shows. This is a 15-minute preview of our conversation, just to give you a little introduction to their show, which I highly recommend. Later, if you'd like to hear the full episode, you just need to go to Rope Podcast. I believe it's an hour long, and that show is going to air this Friday, March 20th. Again, it's the Rope Podcast, and the link is in the show notes. Thank you, and here we go.
We are going to talk about the origin stories for our respective podcasts. So, Brad, go ahead, take it away.
Okay. Now, you guys are on episode number 312.
This will make 313.
Yeah. This will be 313, yeah.
So when did you start?
April of 2015.
Yep.
Did you think you would go this long?
I think we wanted to because our passion for it was there, but it was a lot of, okay, are people going to sign up? How do we get people to do, you know, it was that right. Kind of thing, you know, it like marketing a book, you know, you're like, okay, how do I let people know? What do I do? You know, we were making it up as we went along.
In terms of, did I think it would last this long? I generally don't live in that sort of mentality. I live in the let's make it last as long as people need it. And we still have people signing up and listening. So obviously there's a need.
Having listened to your show on a regular basis, it is still needed. I can assure you that.
Well, thank you.
If nothing else, because I get to refer people over to your show.
And we get to refer our crime and mystery writers over to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. As you know, my show is strictly mystery, suspense, and thriller writers who identify as LGBTQ. And I get emails from people that want to be on the show. When I read their bio and read about their book, I'm like, I would love to have this person on my show. But it had absolutely nothing to do with my format. And I'm like, maybe I should break the rule this week because this guy sounds fantastic. And then at the end, I send them an email back and say, go talk to the guys that wrote.
Thanks. Have you had any problems scheduling guests?
I never have a problem having guests on. From day one, it's never been a problem. I am actually booked up right now about midway through June. Sometimes they'll get within about a month and a half, which is probably where I should book people. But I get nervous.
Yeah, actually, that specific phenomenon is part of the growth arc of our show. When we started, it was kind of just a, hey, let's get out there and talk to some people and introduce our books and introduce a couple other books. And we learned really fast that queer writers, whether they work through a publishing house or not, really, really, really need the boost in marketing. 300 plus episodes later, not a lot of publishers are marketing their authors unless they're top tier authors. So anything we can do to help our queer writers, that suddenly became our mission and our service to our community, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it does.
This has become my volunteer project. We need all the help we can get our voices out there.
I'd like to add that we actually had a very, very unusual beginning.
Yeah.
Our other founder, who's not on this episode, she does our reviews now, Jane Lockwood. It all started in early 2015, where this will give you the rundown of how Rote came to be. Jane was known for writing straight romance, kind of, and BDSM, or, you know, some of the darker stuff, dark romances. And then in one of her books, a character that she had assumed was straight, a male, turned out to be bisexual. And that's how she fell into the genre. And we were talking about it, and of course, at that time, MM romance was the big thing. And we both came to realize later that neither one of us really writes into that specific genre. Jane does more of it than I do. You know, I tend to write what I call queer romance, where what I mean by that is that the story and the characters have other things going on in their lives, but romance may be a thread in the story, but it's not the driving force of the story, you know? So when she and I started putting our heads together and planning what we were going to do, we found this guy, Vance.
Little old me.
He had just released a book, Slumberside, which I highly recommend people buy. It's one of my all-time favorite books. And he was out there in queer sci-fi going, hey, I'm out here. Hi. You know,
I'm a person.
Do you remember, Vance, how it happened?
I don't. All I remember was getting the message from you asking if I had production experience, which I did.
And we pitched the idea. And at that time, we thought, oh, well, since MM seems to be the thing, we'll call ourselves the Three Musketeers. And it was 3M/M-keteers, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's how Rote really started.
What were you thinking?
I don't know, because I didn't write romance. I barely, yeah, barely read it.
He was in the queer sci-fi group. I mean, that was pretty clear. So that's literally the origin story of how it all came to be.
Roughly what episode did we rebrand, though? Because we realized pretty early on that we needed to open up to more genres.
Yeah, well, it's because we got people that contacted us and said, I don't write romance, but would you consider having me on? And I think that's when you said, maybe we need to rethink this whole thing.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the name Rote, what does it mean?
For written on the edge.
And how did the format change?
So I was talking to my friend Anne, who's a marketer, and I literally brought her everything Baz just said. And I went, you know, it's a bigger world out there. There's more fish in the sea. We need to rethink this. I don't remember who exactly came up with written on the edge, condensed down to Rote, but she jumped all over it. And she's like, okay, this you can work with because it's nonspecific. It refers to writing at the edge of your seat, you know, reading on the edge of your seat. Mm-hmm. And you guys as authors are on the edge of society. She's like, so it covers many aspects of what you want to do. I said, and then you can just blanket say, anyone who identifies in the queer spectrum anywhere is a welcome guest. And she was also the one who pushed us to open up to other content types. So not just books, but we've had songwriters, we've had script writers, we've had playwrights, poets, anything. It doesn't have to be a novel. Just be a queer content creator. All of us kind of need that help with visibility. I mean, we don't get a lot of support in the mainstream gatekeeper society, so we got to do what we can.
That was the whole reason I started my show, was for the exposure. I have always been a mystery fan, but I saw male-male pretty much. That's all I saw was either romance or erotica, or there were literary works as well. Mm-hmm. And then I happened to read a couple of gay mystery novels, and it hit me one day in 2019, in the summer, I said, if I didn't know this genre existed, there's probably a lot of other people that don't know either. Mm-hmm. And I said, sometime mid-2020, when my book was done, I think I'll consider a podcast. And then I don't know what happened. The very next month, I had the equipment. I announced the show was coming. And my husband was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm going to do this podcast. And like you, I had no idea how long I was going to be on. I never even thought about it. I just said, I'm going to have this show. And I started reaching out to authors and some very prominent, well-known authors that I didn't think would be interested. And they're like, hell yeah, we'll be on this show.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And yeah, you've had some amazing guests.
My first were Michael Kraft. And then Michael Nava was my second guest. Mm-hmm. And people were like, wow. I think they expected to have a lot of unknowns, which I really try to get a lot of unknowns on the show.
Right.
I want to get the new guy some exposure and help them getting going.
Well, right. Well, and that's one of the primary places we occupy, both podcasts occupy, is we're a discovery tool where consumers can find their next new favorite. And it's a huge win for everybody on both sides.
Absolutely. I'm not interested in just those that are unfamiliar with queer crime genre. A lot of people have their favorite or two favorites, and that's all they read. Mm-hmm. So I like to try and help them broaden their horizons and realize, wow, there's a lot more outstanding authors out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what you just said, there have been some really good studies that show neurologically, if we read the same author, the same type of story over and over, it loses its emotional factor for us. Even though we may love it. Like if you read the same type of, let me pick on romance. If you read the same type of romance that ends in a golden happily ever after time and time again, the first time it's going to be really exciting.
Right.
And the second and third time, it'll be just a feel good.
Like any drug.
Yeah, but it eventually loses that punch. So if you don't mix it up, new authors, new ideas, new genres, you'll suffer from reader fatigue. And that's exactly what you were just speaking to in terms of introducing new authors, because every new author brings a new way to tell a story.
Now, I have a question for you, Brad. Where is the dividing line of how you determine whether someone is appropriate for your podcast? And the reason why I'm saying this is because what about genre mashups, where it could be a crime or mystery, but it may be set in the future?
Or the fantasy ones.
Or something that is massively historical. So I'm just curious where your line in the sand is. And do you ever move it?
Well, I did move it. I can tell you originally the name of the podcast was Gay Mystery Authors. And people would ask, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that it's a gay person writing mysteries, or is it anybody who writes gay mysteries? To clarify it, I then changed it to Gay Mystery Podcast. I don't know how I thought that was going to clarify anything. It's just as just as mysterious as the first name. And that was okay. I had a mix of both gay and straight authors who write queer crime fiction on the show. And almost exactly a year ago, I said, my guests are all going to have to identify as LGBTQ. And the reason was not to exclude individuals, but because I wanted to focus on a marginalized group. So that's how I got to be where I'm today. I would certainly consider a sci-fi or dystopian or any novel, as long as it was mystery, suspense, or thrillers. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of books that have romance. And my rule is crime is crime. What that means is there can be lots of romance, there can be lots of sex, but the crime must be prime in the story. I say 51% of the book should be crime novels.
I like that.
So I may have Michael Nava as a guest, who his novels are clearly mysteries. And then I've had Gregory Ashton and C.S. Poe, who are right on the edge there. They write damn good mysteries.
Yeah, I was curious, especially because of some of the posts in Own Voices, a book group on Facebook. We've been having that discussion. If you have romantic threads in your story, but it is not focused on that, you still get slammed in a review saying, oh, well, this isn't a romance. You know, I mean, that's going around right now again. And it's a recurring theme. There are a lot of queer Own Voice authors who feel almost stifled or up to here, you know, up to your neck of like, oh God, if I put this in, and if people say, oh, look, it's got a romance, you got that automatic crew coming in and they'll read it and go, nope, it's not a romance, you know, and you were never there in the first place.
Well, and that goes back to something Brad said early on in this talk, is that it's all about educating the readers that it can be out there and not be romance.
Right, right. No, exactly. That's why I was like blown away when she said, oh, well, it was sad. They didn't get, I'm like,
I know.
Okay, were we watching the same show?
Well, Baz and I are both in that same group, the Own Voices group. And I actually am one that started one of the conversations about my frustration with romance and male, because my blurb, clearly, I have it stated right on there. There is a touch of romance, but this is not a male novel. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I have that there is a touch of romance on there. And it does in the blurb mention that, and I brought up one of my most written reviews. The person said, well, this isn't really a romance in my book. And I thought, never did I promise you a romance novel. So that is one of my big frustrations. And I have made the decision in the future, all my blurbs will not include the romance in any way.
That may not save you.
Yeah, I know. It won't save me. I know that for a fact.
I was at a book fair in 2018, and my book is an urban fantasy, a guy being chased by reapers and sandmen. He doesn't even have a romantic interest in the book. I was at a book fair. Someone picked it up, asked who the love interest was, and I said there wasn't one. And he literally dropped the book on the table and said, what's the point? And walked away.
And that's fine. At least you know in advance.
Yes, true. And he did.
But still, the expectation's there.
The expectation was there. In your genre, it's more important is the crime wrapped up.
Exactly. And I tell people that is the happily ever after. Because in real life, we don't get that closure all the time.
Right.
Right.
People get away with all kinds of things. So A mystery reader knows at the end there will be closure and a happily ever after in the sense that the crime was solved and the bad guys will get their just desserts. This has come up on the show a few times. Before I came out, I used to sneak into Barnes & Noble and, if you can remember, Borders, some of the big bookstores. And they all had this little corner where it said gay, lesbian. Those nooks don't exist. They've been put in with all the other books.
Right. Yeah. You know what? I remember from that period, and I don't know if it was for you guys as well in your bookstores, but back in the day, every single time there was a gay and lesbian section, across from it was psychology and self-help.
Yep.
Oh, you know what? You're right.
That was it. The one I grew up with too. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I can tell you, I was in this self-help stage during that time and I didn't have to walk very far.
No, you don't. I
never thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought that way. It was either that or it was religion and spirituality.
I was going to say pagan, self-help, gay and lesbian.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're dead on. I never noticed that before. Yeah.
And that hit me when I was a teen, you know, when I was, you know, my first fall into it, all of this was Gordon Merrick's The Lord Won't Mind. And when I found that book as a 16-year-old, it was pure happenstance. And it was in that section. And I remember looking across going, okay, why are we in the self-help psychology section? I don't mind being near the pagans, but you know. There's one thing that it still sticks in my craw is, you know, you have things like Vox and websites like, well, Teen Vogue does a lot of it, where they'll do the top 20 LGBT reads for the summer. And they're all big publishers. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, this is a promo for the big five or big six, whatever it is now, big three, I don't know. And yet it's like, okay. And I have the same complaint about the Lambda Literary. It's like there, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily promoting queer content in the way that it probably was envisioned when they first started. Now there is a huge marketing machine behind all of that. And I can't count on Lambda Literary to give me a list of authors. There's no database that tries to capture every author that's out there writing queer fiction or queer, even queer nonfiction. You know, there's no real way to find, you know, when I want to find a new author, I'll go up and I'll do a quick search of top 10, you know, LGBT authors, you know, but, you know, again, they're from the big five typically.
Can I give you an insider as to why that happens?
I would love to hear that.
The larger publishing houses are the only ones who can afford to send promo copies to these news sources you're talking about.
Exactly. And self-published authors have a challenge.
A lot of challenges.
I can tell you, a lot of challenges. I will tell you, especially the transgender authors that I've spoken with, they have such a hard time getting into a traditional publishing house. And consistently, I hear the same thing over and over is, I submitted my novel and they said, oh, we already did a transgender novel this year.
Right. The one that we do every year.
We checked that box. Moving on.
We need something like that for queer audiences that actually keeps track of this stuff so queer people can find content that is marketed for them. Can count how many Facebook groups I go into that are gay groups, but not necessarily about books. And there are constant people going, okay, I ran out of things to read. Does anybody else have any? Does anybody know any gay authors here? I'm like, wow. You know, so I immediately push our podcast and say, hey, we have over 300 episodes. Go look. We've got tons of authors out there. They don't know where to go. There's no place that is keeping track of this stuff so queer people can find queer content.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it's like, you know, you go, okay, well, you know, obviously somebody thinks we're going to be around next year. So, you know.
No, that's not ever a thought I have. I always have the thought of, well, somebody still needs us.
Well, true. No, it is. I mean, it's kind of the same thing, but yeah, your wording is much better. But it is like, you look at the thing and you just go, you look at our calendar and we go, wow, okay. Yeah. And some of them are repeat people coming back, which is fine, you know, and that's okay that we tell them that they're always welcome to come back.
Well, yeah, because they have a growth arc too, not just their characters.
Right, exactly. I mean, we just had the guy who was the director for the Gay Men's Chorus in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And it was a phenomenal episode. We had a transgender priest in Reverend in London, or in England, in Manchester.
Yes.
She was delightful. She was so amazing. Vance and I could not stop laughing through that entire episode.
And she wrote a historical thriller. You might want to go talk to her.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll have to pass her on to me.
Yeah. She's phenomenal. She's so entertaining. And we find some of these gems of people mm-hmm. that are wonderful writers, but they also have such amazing journey stories that come out in the wash. And, you know, we always tell, well, you know, because you've been on our show, we always tell our guests, don't worry about wandering. We'll bring you back to our show notes. But we often find the best conversations are the ones that ramble, because yeah. sometimes there are just amazing gems of information when we let the guest go.
And that we wouldn't have thought to ask because we right. didn't know that piece of their history.
Right.
And so I have a list of bullet points of what to bring up if necessary. And I never even come close to reaching all right. of them, because once you get started and you have that conversation, you never know where it's going
right,
to go.
Right, 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 right.
There's shows out there that are for authors where it's the same questions every week. Where do you get your ideas? Are you a plotter or are you a pantser? And there's one thriller podcast I listen to. He asks every guest the same exact question every week. And so he doesn't allow his guests to get interesting.
Right. All right, gentlemen, anything else we want to share about the nature of our shows or where we're headed?
I'm going to plug your show. I highly recommend any of my listeners who have not listened to Rote, because you guys always have a great list of guests. You do always know the right questions to ask. So you do an outstanding job, and I'm glad you're there. And I think you were one of the motivations for me to start my own podcast.
Aww. Oh, thank you.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Brad. How are you?
I am great. And awesome. I got to tell you, I'm really happy to have you on today. And I need to tell you why.
I'm happy to be here. So thank you.
For once, I think my readers are going to appreciate that I won't be on my soapbox about sex and gay novels.
Awesome.
I talk about it a lot. It's yeah. usually negative regarding queer novels, and I'm going to mm-hmm. spare the listeners from having me list off all the reasons except one, and that is when it's tossed in for no reason whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Serves no purpose.
Right, exactly.
And because I do that so much, I worry frequently that they think I'm a prude. And having you on today is going to help to prove that is not true.
Because it isn't.
That is correct. So let me get you your introduction.
Mm-hmm.
In the Kink Noir crime thriller series,
yeah.
William D. Price Talks, first installment, Bloodletting, won the grand jury prize at the LA Neo-Noir Novel Film and Script Fest in 2016. An award-winning screenwriter, filmmaker, podcaster, marketer, and educator, Bill's also a former member of BDSM groups in both New York and Philadelphia, and he brings his knowledge of the subculture to the series, where a pansexual private investigator solves crime in New York City's BDSM and LGBT communities. Bill currently resides on the East Coast and leaves no sushi behind. I am with you on that.
All right.
We first connected on Twitter, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
We did. And we started messing each other back and forth about you being on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I was a little wary, a little nervous.
Why?
Several reasons. One, I told you crime is prime.
Yes, it is.
And because your novel involves BDSM and,
right.
and kink and that sort of thing, I was worried, is this really going to be a crime novel, or is it going to be an erotic novel with a PI thrown in or an investigation right. thrown in, which is very common. So that was my first concern.
Mm-hmm.
The other is I was really concerned about the possibility that you had exploited the BDSM society as well as
right.
aroused and glorified people with the murder. And
mm-hmm.
I can tell you, I don't read a lot of books by my guests. And sometimes I do read them, but I don't tell people. And the reason for that is I'm not on here to do a review.
Right.
Justine at the beginning does the book recommendations. Reason is, if I have a guest on, I don't want to have to try and pretend that I liked their book.
That's fine. I understand.
And actually, most of them I don't get around to because I have a very huge series of books that I'm reading. But Despite everything we talked to and some articles I read, I still felt uncomfortable and I said, I just need to make sure. So I haven't read it entirely, but I did dive in. And oh, you've okay. done a good job of not doing all the things I just said.
Thank you. That was my concern too when writing them.
Yeah, I can imagine. It would be really easy to fall down that hole.
And I didn't want to. I mean, BDSM and anything outside of a heterosexual culture is always misrepresented in some way, shape, or form. And I didn't want to do that. And I wanted to make sure there was clear distinctions between safe, sane, and consensual BDSM versus crime, and that these people are just people and are not, you know, strange, bizarre, mentally deficient in any way, shape, or form. So, yeah, I took on a lot.
My first novel, I don't know if you know, is the title is A Body in a Bathhouse. And I think a lot of people were concerned about it being erotic and focused on the sex that goes on in a bathhouse. So I was a little bit concerned of the title. And I finally went with it because it worked. You definitely dive more into it than I did in mine. And you get pretty graphic at times, for sure.
There's a reason for that.
There is a reason for that. It's a perfectly appropriate. And I think...
Oh, thank you for saying so.
I think the novel would have failed had you not done so. So people know you're going to be reading some heavy stuff here. Some of you may find it incredibly hot. Some of you may go, I don't know about this. But either way, you're going to get a good mystery.
Thank you.
So what do you want to talk about first? Did you want to talk about your first book, Bloodletting, or just Kink Noir, the series in general?
Well, I guess I could talk about, I guess I could combine that.
Sure.
When I was writing, I was, it was funny. I finally, after like a million years, decided to go into an MFA program. Bloodletting was originally a screenplay. It was supposed to be made into a film, an R-rated film. And the independent studio that was backing it, they lost all their funding. So that didn't happen. And I'm like, but I like the story. And I wanted to write a novel. And I decided, well, I'm going to convert that script into a novel. And then I had all the concerns that you brought up. Because one of the things that I hate about reading hard-boiled crime is anything in traditional publishing is it's so categorized. There's certain expectations, you know, the tropes. And I didn't like a lot of the tropes. So I didn't want my hero to be my PI to have a military or police background. I didn't want him to be older. I didn't want him to have a negative attitude. I didn't want him to be straight and all of this other fun stuff. And I didn't like hard-boiled crime novels where I'm reading it and it's like, this is hard-boiled, supposedly. It's for an adult audience, yet everything is held back. There's the language isn't real. It's not. It didn't sound legitimate to me. Sex is normally ridiculous in those books if it occurs at all. And I had read novels that had elements of BDSM in it, but the authors hadn't done their research. They didn't know anything about it, and they misrepresented. So I decided to like put all of this into one big ball and write about a private detective who's young, who works within the BDSM and LGBT communities in New York City, which I frequented all the time because I grew up in northern New Jersey. And thankfully, the feedback has been wonderful. I receive a lot of fan letters from people who are like, oh, I get BDSM now. I understand it. I'm not afraid of it. I even had one young couple approach me and said they used the book as sort of a guide of what to do and what not to do. And I was like, I was so touched by that. So I'm like, I like that validation that I got it right because I didn't want to misrepresent. I didn't want to, you know, there's a difference between crime and, you know, lovemaking, you know, within those realms. And yeah, so that's it. But I was like pretty much scared the whole time, you know, like putting this together.
Well, it must have been pretty rewarding to get that feedback.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As a writer, you know, I always want that validation, you know, whether it's from a mentor, an editor, a contest, or, you know, fan letters. And I've gotten them from, man, people from in their 20s to in their 70s, you know, and it's just been really wonderful, the feedback, and that I'm, you know, that they see the sex scenes as something that helps tell the story, that helps with characterization, that it's not gratuitous. There's a method to the madness of everything that I do. So I hope that by the end of the book, or books, people, you know, readers, you know, get that. and I hope they appreciate it.
A lot of authors, you'll hear them say, well, I write for myself, not my readers.
No.
And they're full of shit.
Yes, they are. I concur.
It's really kind of both. I love to write, so that's the good part. But I can't deny I love the validation. So
yes.
So yeah, it makes a difference. It makes a big difference to me.
It does.
Now, you brought your own experiences to the novel.
Yes.
But you also did some research.
Tons for every book. Each book takes about a year.
Tell us about that.
Sure. I want it to be plausible. I want, you know, looking back at like Mike Hammer novels, for instance, from Mickey Spillane. You know, Mike Hammer, he's got his 45 out all the time. He's plugging holes in people. He always gets the femme fatale, and he's just rough and gruff, and all this stuff happens. And I'm like, no, that wouldn't be the case. And as I'm reading it, I'm like, yeah, he'd be going to jail for that right now. You know, it's like. So I didn't want to take liberties, so I interview everything from New York City homicide detectives, crime court reporters, private investigators, which was a real eye-opener in so many ways, coroners, doctors, anything that I have in the book. It's like I write a list. These are the people I need to interview. Psychologists, sociologists, all of it. And just to make sure that it's as accurate as possible, that the books are plausible, that the storylines are plausible. You know, the fantasy in my head is like, yeah, I wish my character would go in the door and have, you know, his gun blazing, but he can't. You know, it's like he can't do that and he won't do that. And I try to take the element of the police out of all the stories, because once that happens, then I don't want to have some scene where, you know, the PIs with the police being interrogated and it's like, oh, those are so old and awful. And I just hate that. So
it makes for an entirely different story.
Yeah, it does. And I changed bloodletting a lot for my initial interviews. I'm like, well, I can't have this in the story. I have to change this. I have to change that. And I'm glad I did, because, you know, I'm a big movie watcher, I'm a big book reader, and I want accuracy. I hate when writers take like creative license just because they might be lazy. And it's like a little research can go a long, long way. And to make your story even more profound and really strike readers. So I don't like to take the easy way out, and that makes it tougher for me, but I appreciate that challenge as a writer to craft a solid story. So
what was the most difficult thing you found in your research? I'm going to guess a lot of people were real concerned about talking to you. Or am I wrong?
No, actually they welcomed it. When I spoke to an FBI agent for the second book, he was like, oh, I'm so glad you called me, because we're so upset about, you know, the FBI being misrepresented again. It's always about misrepresentation with people. And we had a phenomenal conversation. But the thing that was most challenging was talking to an actual private investigator when he said and I'll never forget this line, the only difference between a private investigator and the average citizen is that a private investigator has the legal right to loiter. He said, that's it. That is it. He said, you know, we don't work with the police. The police don't work with us. It's boring. It's dull. And I'm like, then I think I put the book away for 6 months, because I'm like, I have to change a lot. But that was really the big eye opener. It's like private investigators like, yeah, I have a license. I'm like you, but I can loiter. You can't. That's it. And very restricted in what they can and can't do. So, and I put that and those struggles into my story. You know, it's like, well, I need to run a background check on this person. I can only get so much because I'm not a cop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it's like, so what do I do now? So I like that. I think it adds to the storytelling instead of detracts from it.
Yeah, I'm fortunate enough that I have a friend that worked as a LAPD detective for decades and retired. And not long after he retired, he became a PI.
Ah.
Boy, did I use him. To the point that he was just so sick of me talking to him. But one of the interesting things he said to me was, in all the time that he was a police officer, he only remembered ever dealing with a PI, which in the movies and TV would make you think it's probably every other day.
Exactly.
He said in all that time, there was one time that they dealt with a PI, and it really was a mess because the guy got involved and basically messed up the investigation and hurt their investigation.
Oh, that's bad.
They aren't really.
That's real bad.
Yeah. So I guess like you see on film and TV, they don't like them, but they really don't deal with them that, if at all.
No, last year I saw Knives Out. I thought it was fun and it was great. But right from the beginning, you know, when the police are interrogating the family about death of a loved one, you know, there's the private investigator played by Daniel Craig. He did a great job. He's sitting there and it's like he was running the investigation. And I'm like, never in a million years, never. Yeah. Not on this planet, you know, and it's like, so even when I do write fun stuff or comedy stuff in some other way, shape or form, I always stick to a reality. That's just the way I've always been.
Denny Bowie.
Yes.
Your protagonist.
Yes.
Tell us about him.
Oh boy. Now I'm going to get into trouble. Thanks, Brad. No, it was funny when I was first writing him, and it was great. You know, when I heard the podcast with Wendy Hurd talking about unlikable characters, when I was first writing him, my mentor hated him. You know, he's an ass, he's a jerk, and he's despicable. And she said, I want more of you in him. And I was like, okay. So I really went there and I helped, that helped me bring the character to life. He's a young man, grew up in Northern New Jersey, spent a lot of time in New York City. He disappeared to Chicago for a while. He wanted to be a PI. He was a legwork guy for a firm. But what happened with him is he loses focus a lot. He's so distracted by the world, which isn't very good for a PI at all. Mm-hmm. But then his friend was murdered and he came back to New York to try and solve that crime, because it was his former best friend and he felt he owed him that. And then he got caught up into, you know, what became bloodletting. But now he's just like a suburban kid. He's like, what, in his early 20s, mid-20s? Mid-20s. And he's still trying to figure things out. So he's not taken seriously. He's got long hair. He's a punk rocker with long hair. At least that's how he used to identify himself. So people weren't taking him seriously. And so he had just, everything was up against him from the beginning. Talking to police, talking to even witnesses, like, oh, are you really a PI? You know, and it's like, yeah, I am.
I would think there'd be benefits to that, though.
There are. And I think that goes as the books progress and the communities in which he thrives and, you know, get to know him and his reputation starts to like go up. It does serve him well because of how he looks, because people don't expect it. I guess, you know, to steal a line from, what was it, the Devil's Advocate film, they'll never see him coming because nobody would expect him to maybe even carry a gun on occasion or to know self-defense moves or to be an investigator. So he could get into places where a lot of, you know, police definitely couldn't. And that really helps him all the time, like going into clubs. You know, frequenting gay clubs and such and BDSM clubs in New York City to get information. You know, he looks like he belongs there. So that's a benefit.
Reminds me a lot of the premise of Columbo where the...
Love Columbo.
Yeah, the villain's downfall was they assumed he didn't have a clue as to what he was doing, which was the beauty of it all.
Yeah.
Sounds similar situation that if people don't think you know what you're doing, they're probably a little more open to talk about some things.
Yeah, and that was what I love Peter Falk's character, you know, with Columbo. It was just beautiful. He looked like this bumbling fool, and that was his trick. And that was great. And yeah, I just loved that series. That was fantastic.
It wasn't really a mystery. You knew right away, I mean, within the first 5 minutes, you knew who the killer was.
And it was like, how's he going to figure it out?
That was the show. How did he figure it out? And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't do that in my books. I think the thing that really bothers me about thrillers, detective stories, is when the writer, again, I contributed to laziness, is something's revealed at the end of the book that the detective knew, that the PI knew, that the reader was never given information about. And it's like, well, that, you know, I'm here trying to figure out what's going on. You're keeping information from me. That's not cool. So I don't do that in my books. It's like the information that the guy gets is the same thing that the readers get. And hopefully they can help look at the clues and figure things out at book's end, you know, so.
Yeah. When I ask authors your inspirations or what books did you like to read in mystery novels, Agatha Christie's always on there and some of the usual suspects. Ooh. But I have never been a fond of Sherlock Holmes. And the reason is.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever played fair. You know.
No.
He would solve a crime by saying, well, the mud on that rug can only be found on Mount Johnson, west of here. You know, how the hell was I supposed to know that as a reader? I, you know. I think when I read it early on, I enjoyed his novels. But then when I started really wanting to read real mysteries and ones that I could fail at solving but had the chance of solving, mm-hmm. I kind of gave up on Sherlock. So.
Yeah, I did as well. And Agatha Christie for me. I can't read either one. Mickey Spillane. The only two authors that I've really loved, and I'm sort of upset that I've read everything Raymond Chandler wrote. But I do want to go back and revisit the books because I think he was a great craftsman. There's a poetry to what he does. He was a firm believer, though, in not focusing on the PI. And he said his life should be left out of it. And that's not what I do in my books because I want someone, my Denny Bowie, his life is pretty crazy. And on top of it, he's got to solve a crime. But yeah, I like Raymond Chandler because of the way he presented things. Once in a while, though, he would still throw in like a little scene that would irk me. But, you know, but I love what he did.
Yeah, you brought up something I've mentioned probably too often on this podcast is I came across an old article written during the 20s on how to write a mystery. And mm-hmm. the rules were interesting. The one that floored me, though I shouldn't have been surprised, was never have it be someone like a maid or a butler.
Right.
The killer needs to be a person of worth.
Yeah, okay. I know.
So that was shocking to have that. But they also stressed people don't want to know anything about the sleuth's life.
Right. I think that Raymond Chandler wrote that. He did write an essay on, you know, I think that's where you might have seen it.
It could have been.
Yeah.
So, but that's changed. Nowadays, that's not true for sure.
No. And I welcome that. I want to see a real character. I want to see somebody with real trials and tribulations, and yet they have to overcome that somehow to solve maybe a bigger problem for somebody else, you know, to serve the community in some way. And that's what my guy does. You know, he wants to, you know, he knows how disenfranchised BDSM communities are, as well as, you know, gay communities. And the bulk of the stories are about like, yes, these are real people. They're normal people. They're just maybe a little bit different from what you're accustomed to. And, you know, if in the books, if you're of good character, you're fine. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. So.
Yeah, my very first experience with people in the BDSM culture. I worked at a hotel in North Carolina. I was with Marriott for years, but my very first job was working as a bellman. And there was a Jehovah's Witness convention in town. And also one of our sales managers booked a small bondage S&M group in the hotel. They were called Tar Heel Leather. And she had no idea. Nice. I guess she didn't ask them what that was about. And what was absolutely fascinating was you would see these folks coming down from their room to go back to their banquet hall where they were meeting every day. And you know, they were definitely dressed in the non-traditional manner that you don't expect to see in a Marriott lobby. I remember one woman that just, she had the only thing covering her nipples were her suspenders. And, and to see the Jehovah's Witness folks waiting in the lobby for their vans to their events. Their faces were priceless.
I can imagine.
Absolutely priceless. I'll never forget those memories. But actually, what was really interesting to me was after seeing what came across as this wild, kinky crowd, which they probably were, on Sunday afternoon when everyone was checking out, they were wearing suits and you know, just blended back in with society. So,
yeah,
just like celebrities, they're normal folk.
Yeah. You know, they're dressed for playtime and then there's not playtime and they're like anybody else. And that's part of the beauty of it. Puritanism in American culture still runs deep. Mm-hmm. And there's an age of Victorianism never ended that, you know, people might say, hey, that's not right or cool, whatever. And then behind closed doors, they're whoever they want to be. And so it was really fun, you know, the first time I went to a BDSM club it was great. It felt so, to be sincere, I was scared going in. And then when I went in and I was like, everybody's cool. You know, it was like, this is great. And I just felt like, almost like I was home, you know, like, you know, which was such a wonderful feeling, you know, and I met some amazing, bright, totally artistic people who are really phenomenal in the BDSM community. And it's just been fantastic. Great experience.
Yeah, I have, for lack of a better word, dabbled in that a little bit, not heavily. Mm-hmm. One of the things that intrigued me about your book, it's because I find it so fascinating, is in my wild days, and I would close the bars every night. And then mm-hmm. when the bars closed, we went to the party after the party.
Right.
Usually ran until 6 in the morning. And quite frequently, guys that were acquaintances of mine, we would end, and actually one real good friend, we would end up at a local BDSM club that they mm-hmm. had. And all the toys were there. And right. I was really intrigued and just fascinated by it. I never went in on my free time other than the parties, and I don't know why. I certainly wasn't mm-hmm. encouraged to come in and participate, but never did. But it's great to read a book that gives a understanding of it without, like I said, the usual stereotypes that you read or that sort of thing.
Thank you. I didn't want, you know, I didn't want to be exploitive in any way, shape, or form. And I think that's some people's fears. Other people are intrigued by it and they want to learn more, which is great. And I'm glad you had that experience, though, and you got to see people just being people. It's just fun. You know, it's adult playtime. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. When you, at least when I was growing up, you know, I was wondering, like, what's wrong with my head? What's wrong? You know, I couldn't find anything. I didn't know, like, these fantasies that I had, where they came from, and I'm not right. And then I found out that I was, and it was such a relief. That's pretty much it. So even in the book, Denny Bowie, he's exploring new things about his sexuality. And I think that's great, too. And that also progresses as the stories go with his relationships, because he does have a boyfriend and a girlfriend at the same time. And I've never been able to make that work, but you know, I'm glad that he can, you know, it's like.
So other than entertaining, are there mm-hmm. misconceptions that you hoped to clear up for the readers?
Yeah, well, a lot, like that someone's into, and I hate to say into, but enjoys expressing love through BDSM, that they're not sick and twisted, that they're not demented. I challenge myself every time with that, with the story. It's like, oh, how are people going to perceive this? How are they going to perceive someone who's bisexual or pansexual or gay? And I work constantly in the books to make the distinctions between good people and bad people. And that's it. And, you know, one reader said, it's beautiful. You present these, you know, they're people. And, you know, I understand the struggles of the one character who's transgender and the conflict going on in this person's head and, you know, what they're enduring in pain and suffering when they shouldn't have to. I hope for a world where there's no categories at all at one point. That'd be wonderful. Labels. And I try to put that into the book that, and I think it's, you know, I included this in the first book. It was a scene out of my own life where one day after high school, I got on a train, the path, went to New York City. Beautiful day, Greenwich Village. I was in Washington Square. And as a young writer, I just wanted to sit and listen to people. So that's all I did all day long. And I hung out with, they didn't know I was hanging out. I was sort of like, you know, eavesdropping on everything. Lesbian couple, gay men, people who were into BDSM, and a whole array of people. And they all spoke about the same things. Concern over jobs, love, you know, am I going to have enough money to get food this week? And it was just and all different races and whatnot. And I was like, wow, we're all the same. And that's what I try to bring to the books. If someone's a criminal, they're a criminal, but their crimes have no reflection on their love choices or anything else that they do. It shouldn't reflect an entire group. So I make those distinctions as best I can.
Yeah, not unlike a few decades ago, and maybe not even that far back, where any homosexual or anyone that was unusual was either a victim or the villain.
Yeah.
And it was always one or the other.
Absolutely, yeah.
And in a movie that, let's just say in the movies, a lot of lesbian and gay men died very frequently killing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I have that. Or it's funny, as we were talking, I was just thinking of how gay people are often portrayed in horror movies because they're always there for like comic relief. And it's like, and it, again, it's the same thing. It's like, oh, he's the gay male character and he's funny, but he's not tough or strong. He can't be, he can't defend it. So I always look for those movies where it's like somebody's working against that grain because of what you said. You know, they're either victims, villains, and it's just not reality for any group, any type of person. So that's why it's like sometimes it was hard for me. It's like, okay, my villain is in this story, particular story, she's a lesbian. And it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to like paint anyone who's a lesbian as, you know, in a negative light. But my guy's girlfriend, she's bi and she hangs out with lesbian women and they're all cool. And again, I have to make sure that the distinction's there because I don't want anyone to feel slighted in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, these books are tough to write sometimes.
I'm a Walking Dead fan. Even after 10 years and we've seen it take a nosedive, I continue to watch out of hope that it will bounce back. One thing they've done great and not so great at the same time is they do have a lot of queer characters on the show.
Yes, they do.
And they aren't, they're just there. I don't think I've ever seen any homophobia. Nobody reacts, or they're just part of the landscape with everybody else.
Right.
The negative is, granted, it's a show where a lot of people get killed. Every single one of them had their lover killed. So they're all, single. If they aren't single, it lasts maybe an episode. So that's still a complaint. I actually see people online complain about that. Well, you just have a happy gay couple on that show one time. Let them live at least a season.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I can't remember the movie's name. I saw it was a science fiction horror and it was found footage. And the hero was a young gay man who had a boyfriend. And that was it. That was it. It was like, that's just like any other movie where you would see, you know, a heterosexual couple. And it's like, this didn't have to be part a big storyline element. It was just, that was it. And I just really appreciated that so much. It was just beautiful to see. And that had no bearing on anything. And I just loved it. And I hope we see that more and more. People just realize that this isn't anything to be exploited in any way, you know, for a storyline.
You have a podcast.
Yes, I do.
Last Knock.
Yep, The Last Knock. Yes, sir.
And I listened to it actually this morning. I listened to the worst horror movies of 2020.
Ah, yes. I remember it well.
You guys are very funny. And
good, thank
they
you.
They sounded absolutely dreadful.
They are. Stay away from them, please.
Oh, I'm not a huge horror fan because there are so many bad ones. And the only good bad one I like is like Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Bad one, yes.
I do like apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic bad movies. And there's tons of those. Those I enjoy if they're bad, but horror movies, not so much. But how did that podcast come about?
Oh, man. I've known Johnny Numb, my co-host, for, man, what, about 9-10 years now. And we would always talk horror movies. And my significant other at the time said, why don't you guys have a podcast? And that's where it started. And now we're up to over 350 episodes. And we've been doing it for about 7-8 years now. And so it came from that. And we're never out of show ideas. I thought, like, 250 episodes ago, we'd like, I guess we're done.
No.
it just never ends.
Yeah, I don't think it ever will.
So I just love horror movies. And like you said, most of them are bad. And it's like looking for, because I don't think, he comes from a literary background as well as I do. And one of the things that we wanted to do was point out that horror is not a disposable genre. And it's the same thing with crime thrillers. It's not a disposable genre. This isn't, oh, it's a genre piece. It's like, whatever. No, it doesn't have to be that way. So, you know, that's another reason why I write the books that I do and hope that, like, they're different and it, like, adds a whole new element and flavor to that, the crime thriller genre, I hope.
Well, I would guess there's so many bad movies that they can be done cheaply, such as Halloween. All they had to do was put a mask on a guy. But do you think a lot of the reasons they're bad is a lot of new directors are pushed to go into horror to get their start?
Yeah, and they even say that with, you know, screenwriters and, you know, low-budget Hollywood horror films are $4 million or less. A lot of people don't see $4 million as low-budget, but, you know, Hollywood's a whole different animal. A lot of people think – I think a lot of people have misconceptions about the horror fan base. where it's, oh yeah, they love this stuff. Let's do that again for the 80 millionth time. No, it's like, don't do that again. Do something new, do something different. And I found that the same thing with not just the films that I watch, but with the, you know, crime thrillers that I read. It's like, I'm reading this book. I've read this book before. I read it when it was first came out in the '30s now, and then again in the '40s. And it's like, can we do something else? Can we do something different? So I think that's why, you know, with horror, it's, you know, you're going to have an audience. You know, horror fans just crave horror movies. They're going to see it no matter what. But I think they're getting more and more savvy as time goes on. And they're like, no, we want something different, something better. So,
well, I'm going to ask a couple of questions that are probably going to be hard to answer, or maybe they won't be.
I'll do my best.
Do you think is the worst horror movie that you've seen?
I cannot say on this show because I know the director and he knows me, so I can't say that. But there are some that are so horrifically bad that it's multiple. I actually really couldn't pick one out. I don't even remember the name of one of them. There's oh, what's the name? It was a Turkish ripoff of The Exorcist, Seitan, S-E-I-T-A-N, I believe, or S-E-Y-T-A-N. And it was just, it's one of those, it's so bad, it's laughable, but not too much. It's like you can only laugh a little bit. And it was just a straight ripoff. They had like a $10 budget. The sound was bad. The color was bad. I mean, it just, list goes on. And that was just, I wouldn't recommend that to anyone on Earth ever.
The worst that comes to my mind, and it may be because it's probably the most recent that I've seen, and I expected it to be bad, but it wasn't good bad. It was just bad. And the original 1961, 1962 Little Shop of Horrors.
Is awful. That's hideous.
Yeah, it was painful to go through.
Yes, very painful. Very painful, even though you get to see a young Jack Nicholson in his earliest role. Yeah. And the transfer is awful. That they never restored that film in any way, shape or form. It's just,
It looks like a really cheap college film.
Yeah. Copied on a Xerox first.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's pretty bad. So if you like bad movies, don't even bother with that one.
Steer clear.
Way clear of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, before we wrap it up, we got to do awkward questions authors get.
Oh, you're spinning the wheel.
Spin the wheel. So, as you know, this is questions that are either awkward or just downright rude or weird that real authors have gotten.
I love it.
So hang on while I spin the wheel. Okay. This is an odd one.
I'll take it.
Why doesn't your main character speak like a billionaire?
He's from a blue collar town in northern New Jersey. Every other word is the F word, pretty much. Not every other word with him, with his girlfriend it is, but not with him. He's not that guy. He spends a lot of time in his head ruminating. He wants to, he's still trying to figure a lot of stuff out. So he's not fully grounded yet. He's not, even in the fourth book I'm writing now, he's like, my dad's an adult. I'm not an adult, you know, and he doesn't think he'll ever get there. So he's not that savvy. He doesn't have like a gazillion dollars to fall back on to like throw around. So yeah, billionaire. No, he wouldn't want to be, even if he was a billionaire, he wouldn't want to talk like one. He would think that that's not being authentic.
Yeah.
So.
That questions like that one are so random. I always wonder what the story is behind it. It probably has something to do with the books that particular writer have written, but it's a really strange question to me.
Mm-hmm.
So we have William D. Price Talk, and the series is Kink Noir. Your first book is Bloodletting. Are we going to see more than the three that are out?
Yeah, I'm working on the fourth one now. All of the titles come from something within the BDSM realm. It doesn't necessarily, usually the titles have dual meanings. The fourth one's going to be called Bondage. Of course, it's not what you think it is. It's something more than that as well. And this is venturing into another area of BDSM that some people might think is weird or creepy. And again, the challenge is to present it as, no, these are normal adults doing X, Y, and Z, and take it from there.
I want to thank you for being on the show. You're one of the guests that makes me wish I had a three-hour show. I have more scraps of notes here, and we didn't touch probably half of them. When the next one comes out, we'll have to have you back.
I would love to come back. Thank you so much. Look forward to it.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.